You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 24th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Hagai Matar, award-winning Israeli journalist and executive director of Plus 972 Magazine's Advancement of Citizen Journalism, on the state of Israeli politics after the ousting of Benjamin Netanyahu. Meanwhile, the bipartisan Gang of Ten has reached a deal on a $974 billion infrastructure package. And a reminder, you still need five more Republicans to clear the filibuster. And they're Republicans. So. President Biden announces a program to combat gun violence that includes, wait for it, more funding for the police. Crime bill Biden doesn't change his stripes. Despite a deluge of lobbying by Facebook, Google, and more, the House committee has advanced the, or a House committee has advanced the American Choice and Innovation Online Act, an antitrust bill that seeks to curb big tech abuses. It still has to advance in the House and the Senate. Let's see if the GOP's anti-big tech posture has any teeth beyond just sucking up to Trump. The Biden administration has fired the pro-Trump head of U.S. Border Patrol, Rodney Scott, in a long-awaited move. One could say that he was deported from his position. Or one could not say that, honestly. The Supreme Court sided with a high school student who was suspended for saying the F-word in a Snapchat that she sent while she was off school grounds, which civil rights groups are calling a victory for the First Amendment. And in more good Supreme Court news, the court also ruled yesterday that police aren't always permitted to enter someone's home without a warrant for a minor crime. It's the little things, I guess. And lastly, Brazilian Environment Minister Ricardo Salles was forced to resign after allegedly obstructing a police investigation into illegal deforestation in the Amazon. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I am obviously not Sam. I say this every Thursday, but you're going to see more of me on Thursdays than you normally do. For people new to this program, people new to the show who may have come due to the events of this week, I am the co-host of the Majority Report, Emma Vigeland, and I will be guiding you through this show. Let's get into it, shall we? Yesterday, General Mark Milley, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it's always a difficult thing to say. The S, no one knows where it goes, but I digress. He went viral a little bit by responding to a question from Representative Matt Gaetz about critical race theory, the latest manufactured outrage by Fox News that we're all forced to talk about now because apparently it's the biggest problem in the country that's entirely made up. Parents are having meltdowns at PTA meetings, etc. Matt Gaetz asked Mark Milley this question. Let's take a listen.
First of all, on the issue of critical race theory, etc., I'll obviously have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university, and it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white, and I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that? I want to find that out. I want to maintain an open mind here, and I do want to analyze it. It's important that we understand that, because our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians, they come from the American people. So it is important that the leaders, now and in the future, do understand it. I've read Mao Zedong. I've read Karl Marx. I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist. So what is wrong with understanding, having some situational understanding about the country for which we are here to defend? And I personally find it offensive that we are accusing the United States military, our general officers, our commissioned, non-commissioned officers, of being, quote, woke or something else because we're studying some theories that are out there. That was started at Harvard Law School years ago, and it proposed that there were laws in the United States, antebellum laws prior to the Civil War, that led to a power differential with African Americans that were three-quarters of a human being when this country was formed. And then we had a Civil War and Emancipation Proclamation to change it. And we brought it up to the Civil Rights Act in 1964. It took another 100 years to change that. So look it, I do want to know. And I respect your service, and you and I are both Green Berets. But I want to know. And it matters to our military and the discipline and cohesion of this military. And I thank you for the opportunity to make a comment on that.
Thank you, General.
A comment? Yeah, more like a smackdown. Matt Gaetz shaking that head of his. A reminder that Gaetz is under investigation for potentially sleeping with a minor. But that's beside the point. It's just necessary to understand the context of who Matt Gaetz is. The thing about critical race theory is that it's essentially a placeholder for, you know, any type of education that the right wing fears won't indoctrinate our kids to be good little capitalists and, you know, good who have a faux sense of superiority about America, about their own whiteness, about our own history that's dominated by people that look like them. And that's all about waving the flag. I mean, that's really what the core of this fear is. And it's a completely, you know, illegitimate and manufactured fear. I can't say it enough. The only reason we're even talking about critical race theory, which has been around for decades at this point, taught in law school, it's about looking at our legal system through a comprehensive, holistic way about how we have treated Black people and people of color unfairly under the law. It's really not that groundbreaking. It's just because it's a part of the Fox machine, and they've done this successfully many times, creating an outrage out of whole cloth. But it is good that someone like General Milley is saying stuff like this, because one, it's important that we have someone in office who's speaking out about the critical race theory outrage and that it's BS, and hopefully trying to put a lid on this, even though Fox is talking about it nonstop and OAN has picked it up and all the right-wing media can't get enough of it. But why we need more people in our military and intelligence communities talking about things like this is because it triggers the right wing. And we might, by triggering the right wing, get what we want policy-wise. I don't know. It's still a pipe dream. But listen to what Laura Ingraham had to say in response to this speech by Milley.
We are sending our tax dollars to this military to an attempt to weed out so-called extremists, which just means conservative evangelicals, as far as I can tell. We're paying for that? Why is Congress not saying we're not going to give you a penny until all of this is eradicated from the military budget? Nothing.
Whoa.
This is my offer to you. Nothing. That's what I would say.
Cool.
I'm totally outraged by him and his ridiculous response today. Sorry, Congressman.
Base Laura Ingraham. We have a deal, Laura Ingraham. You want to cut military funding because they want to teach critical race theory? I mean, sure. Between this and the woke CIA stuff, you know, I'm all for it. If they're going to come around and think that our military and our intelligence institutions are in some way woke and not a part of the good America that they knew, I am all for it. Let us cut funding to the CIA, to the FBI, to the military. Thank you so much, Laura Ingraham. You know, we've really come to some sort of... Actually, I need to back it up. Please don't do this, right wing. You would trigger the libs so hard. I'd be so damn upset if you cut military funding.
Yeah, I'll just comment on his invocation of Mao, Marx, and Lenin. Like, that was, I think people got a little bit too excited about it based on the headlines. Like, he was saying that in a "we're not afraid to confront anything" type of way. And that's true. Like, the military needs to not be able to, or be able to confront ideas like that. They can't be afraid of it. And you wouldn't want a military that puts their head in the sand about things like that. But I also think the function of the military is going to, like, the military was supposed to guard the Black Hills for the Native Americans based on treaties. And they said a lot of positive things about that, but they ultimately paved the road to it, too. This is kind of not an unfamiliar place for the American military to be in with regards to right-wing populism.
No, and I took issue too with the equation of, you know, whatever boogeyman the right wing's created in terms of critical race theory mm-hmm. and the scariness of communism and reading Lenin. But, you know, this is the best, like, this is one of the better things we can hope for. And for the target audience, Matt, like,
yeah,
it's effective.
And I think it'd be very funny to see, like, Rufo debate Milley, like, just based on that, the optics of that.
Yeah. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be speaking to Hagai Matar, Israeli journalist, executive director of Plus 972 Magazine's Advancement of Citizen Journalism. They're a great Israeli magazine. We'll be right back.
In the meantime, we have an ad today, and that is for Geology. They've been running a great deal with us. They sent me some free skincare recently. Right at the end of quarantine, got to get my, you know, my face in shape for socializing again, seeing people. And, you know, everyone's just been saying how good my skin looks. And that's a very nice thing to hear. What is Geology? It's a simple skincare routine formulated for daily use. And, you know, what's really nice about it is that it personalizes your skincare routine. Whether you're a complete neophyte, you've been washing your face with dish soap, or if you're someone like me who has, has been going to the dermatologist for years and trying to figure out, like, what exactly works for you. So if you come from nothing, they'll give you something that will work for you. Or if you have very, you know, intricate care routine, it can be integrated very easily. And you start with, like, a quick little survey that you take on their website, and you start with four different products: a face wash, a morning face cream, a night face cream, and an eye cream. And I've personally taken on the night cream, or the eye cream, as my primary product from them. And what I really like about the night cream is that it takes out the bags under your eyes, and it, you know, the wrinkles are kind of like going away. And it's their best-selling product. So, you know, I'm on to something, obviously, along with everyone else. And, you know, it's just a really great skincare routine that I've, you know, gotten used to now. And you get a 90-day supply of the skincare, and you can subscribe and save after that if everything's working for you, or you can just go a la carte like I've done with the eye cream. And they've got customer service and skin consultations with, like, dermatologists online that will help you, like, how to use the product, or if you're using too much or too little, what you can expect. And you'll start noticing results right away. Like I said, like, people really give me looks, saying nice things to me. We all love that. So head over to geology.com and take their free skincare quiz, save up to 40% on your 30-day trial, and check out the link in the podcast and the YouTube description. You'll save 40% off your 30-day trial today.
All right. Do we have Hagai? Okay. Oh, there we are. So I would like to welcome to the program Hagai Matar, award-winning Israeli journalist and executive director of Plus 972 Magazine's Advancement of Citizen Journalism. Welcome to the show, Hagai.
Hey there. Hello. Thanks for having me.
So for those of you who don't watch our Peacock show, I interviewed Hagai a few weeks ago, or a little bit of a while ago, before things were fully settled in the Israeli elections. And so I wanted to have him back on to talk about the outcome, Netanyahu ousted after 12 years as prime minister. Just set the stage for the audience, if you could, about how this came to be and kind of some background on why this all culminated in the ousting of Bibi after all these years.
Sure. So it's a very long story, but in essence, Netanyahu has been the focal point of Israeli politics for the past few years. We've seen Israeli politics kind of move away from questions of ideology, of different political camps. We've actually seen more and more Israelis turn to the right as their kind of central political agenda. But at the same time, the questions that have been on the table for most Israelis were Netanyahu, yes or no? Can we continue? Do we want to continue under Netanyahu after 12 years in power? Or is it time to move on? And that has become a very polarizing question. You have almost 50% of Israelis saying that Netanyahu is one of the best leaders we've ever had. We need to stay with him for as long as possible. And a little over 50% that do not feel the same, which is what allowed this new government to be formed. The challenge in forming this new government was that those other 50% or a little over don't agree with each other on almost anything else, which made it almost impossible to form its coalition, but eventually they did.
Right, and I want to get back to that, but, you know, first, since most of our viewers, I would imagine, are American, but hello to everybody who's watching internationally, I'd love if we could just kind of give a bit of a recap of the leadership of Netanyahu and, you know, what that meant in terms of the occupation as well as the Jewish nation state law from a few years ago. You know, what was accomplished by his far right administration and kind of where he took politics in Israel, just domestically for them, and then also in relation to occupied Palestine.
Sure. So when Netanyahu came into power in 2009, it was actually his second term. But when he came into power then, the feeling was that the idea of reaching peace with Palestinians and a two-state solution is such a given that any politician, even on the right, has to commit to it, at least verbally. These were the Obama years at the time. And Netanyahu stepping into power, one of the first things he did was surprise people on the right by making this statement that he supports the two-state solution and that's where he's going. And he went on to continue negotiating with Palestinians. And things seemed like they were a continuation of what we've seen in previous administrations. However, at the same time, Netanyahu did devote these 12 years in power to completely dismantling the notion of negotiations for peace. He devoted this time to entrenching the occupation, making it as everlasting as possible, and basically removing the question of how to deal with Palestine and Palestinians from the table of Israeli politics. So if at the time the question of how to end the occupation was central to Israeli politics, 12 years later, he has made it so that almost all Israelis would want either formal annexation, de facto annexation, or keeping things exactly as they are. But the idea of resisting the apartheid nature of this military regime and saying that people in this land all deserve equality, that is currently a fringe point of view in Israeli politics. And that is one of Netanyahu's biggest victories in this 12 years in power.
Well, that's a Herculean accomplishment, let alone a villainous one. I mean, I'm curious about what steps that were taken, not to get too bogged down in this, but I think the context is enormously important. You know, one was, I would say, the sparking of conflict in order to kind of cement and flex his muscle, as we saw even recently, which failed. He was not able to maintain power, but this was not the first time that he'd engaged in these kinds of activities. What were some of the ways that he was able to create that mass consensus in just, you know, less than two decades?
So it's true that Netanyahu has not shied away from escalating violence on occasion. We saw that recently. We saw that in 2014 in the massive assault on Gaza, the devastating assault at the time. But I think actually a more indicative part of his rule has been to try to calm things down and to progress the occupation and to progress Israeli control of Palestinian territories in a way that would spark as little resistance as possible. I think the rationale for him has been that the occupation had several downfalls from an Israeli perspective. I'm not talking about the obvious Palestinian perspective. And one was the cost in human life that Palestinian resistance was causing a severe price to human life on the Israeli side. There was a cost in the to the economy. There was a cost to tourism. And there was also a cost to Israel's legitimacy in international diplomacy. And I think Netanyahu made it his kind of project throughout these 12 years to reduce those prices, to make them almost non-existent. And if you take the first decade of the 2000s, you would see that Israel suffered over 1,000 casualties. And if you look at the second decade, we're talking about 100 or a little over that. So the idea that you can diminish the number of Israelis killed as part of this so-called conflict, which is by no means a symmetrical conflict, is one that Netanyahu has been very committed to, while Palestinians have been dying at the same rate and even faster. In terms of international diplomacy, getting the sort of legitimacy that Netanyahu was able to get from Donald Trump, of course, but also from Arab regimes in the region, showing that there's no significant pushback from the EU as Israel expands its control of the West Bank and continues with the siege on Gaza. So basically kind of dismantling point by point all those things that the moderate left in Israel has been saying, that we can't afford to continue with the occupation because of all these different costs. He's been able to say no, we can, you know, have our cake and eat it too. We can have the occupation and reduce the cost of lives and get legitimacy and have a blooming economy. That was basically the Netanyahu message, and I think it's been resonating with Israelis.
Right. I mean, and even you talk about him as a polarizing figure, I would imagine from what I've read, that largely stems from these corruption investigations that were a bit of his downfall. And then in 2018, there hasn't been a budgetary agreement since that time. So the country was essentially in deadlock, which led to his ousting. Talk about the impact of the inability to form a coalition government in that time. And was it really mostly the corruption investigations that led to that kind of brewing anti-Bibi cohort that was eventually successful in recent weeks?
So to start with that question, I think there were very different motives for different people. Part of this coalition that was formed against Netanyahu comes from Palestinian citizens that Netanyahu has been inciting against throughout his career, really building his career on incitement against Palestinian citizens. And they've obviously wanted to see him out of power. So that is one part of this unlikely coalition. Another is the Israeli left, shrunk though it may be, that does oppose the occupation and everything Netanyahu represents in the economy and in everything else. And then you also have kind of your moderates, your center, that were troubled by Netanyahu's corruption, his assaults on the media, on the courts, on the prosecution, on the police, basically his attempts to dismantle different gatekeepers and checks and balances that are necessary for a liberal democracy. So they're not concerned with occupation so much, but they were concerned with these issues. Another aspect of criticism has been his deep alliance with the ultra-Orthodox communities. And you have people who are devout secular side that really oppose this opposition with the ultra-Orthodox. They fear religious oppression against secular Jewish Israelis. And that's a sort of pushback from them. And then lastly, you had people on the right who felt that either Netanyahu was not taking to the country right enough, or were just sad and disappointed not to see him move away, that he's clinging to power and not making room for alternative leaders to grow under him, basically sabotaging new leaders one after the other. I think this alliance of the right, the center, the liberals, the secular, the left, and the Palestinians, that's basically the coalition that now formed this new government.
So, I mean, before we even dive further into the coalition, before he was ousted, reports came out that he was essentially trying to, or did form, alliances with essentially Jewish supremacists and people in the Knesset who were incredibly extreme and were not necessarily a part of Israeli politics for decades up until this point, until this kind of far right movement has become a lot more normalized. Talk about that dynamic as well. Luckily, I mean, the silver lining, I guess, is he wasn't successful in that effort, but those politicians and those remnants are still there.
Yeah, you're very right. As part of this kind of moving of the goalpost, as the Israeli society was moving more and more to the right, part of what we've seen is that it's not just the center that's becoming more right. We've actually seen right-wingers becoming much more fanatical, much more fundamentalist, much more fascist in their approaches, which means that for the first time in a very long time, we're seeing outspoken fundamentalist fascists in Knesset. And that is really part of that shift that's been happening. It's been part of the legitimization that Netanyahu has been giving to these extremists. He's really invested a lot of his own political capital to allow those forces to grow and to succeed and to enter parts of the Israeli society in which they didn't have room before. And I think that is a very dangerous part of his legacy, because those people are now, they're here to stay. Even if Netanyahu himself might move on, we will see them as part of Israeli politics for the long term.
And the kind of views they espouse essentially are...
We'll talk about from the religious perspective, it's extreme homophobia and basically wanting to create a halakha state, a state run by Jewish biblical law and not by civilian liberal law. So that's the religious side. And then their kind of nationalistic side, their fascist side, is essentially proposing ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and within Israeli Palestinian communities, Israeli citizens. So these are very, very extreme views.
Well, cool. They're saying it out loud. I mean, that's I'm being sarcastic. My point is that that's happening already in practice. But then when you have people who are explicit and proud of that kind of ideology, it takes on a whole new ugly formation. So let's get into the new coalition that was formed, right? So as you said, it's largely a result of anyone but Bibi politics and Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett. They formed this kind of coalition of hawks and right-wingers and even Palestinian Islamists. How is that two-headed monster, if you will, going to work? And what even though they did form this governing coalition that contains some ideological diversity, Bennett, who's going to take over, is incredibly right-wing, and many might say further right than Netanyahu.
Yeah, you're very right. He is, for a very long time, Bennett has been kind of the right-wing opposition to Netanyahu, either from within or from without successive Netanyahu governments. So having him in power as sort of a replacement for Netanyahu is definitely not good news from a leftist perspective. At the same time, he is bound by this unlikely coalition. And we don't yet know what that means and what that will look like. We've just started last week. This coalition government was sworn in, and we don't know what sort of policies it will promote. On the one hand, as you were saying, Naftali Bennett, a right-winger as prime minister, we have a series of very hawkish, some of them very extreme right-wingers in government, in top positions, in the Ministry of Justice, and Internal Affairs, and the finance. So there's definitely a risk in this very right-wing government. At the same time, it cannot function without the more liberal and leftist and Palestinian factions of the government. So what we've actually been seeing, and this is within this two-week period that the government has been able to survive this long, we've actually already started seeing opposition on the left to certain policies. One example is the so-called citizenship law that is renewed every year, has been renewed every year for 18 years, essentially preventing Palestinians from the West Bank or Gaza from marrying and gaining citizenship in Israel if they marry to Israeli citizens, usually Palestinians, Israeli citizens. So this essentially a racist law that many in politics admit is meant for demographic purposes to prevent Palestinians from changing the balance of demography between Jews and Palestinians. So this law has been automatically renewed every year for 18 years. And suddenly the government can't get enough votes to pass this bill because it has people on the left and the Palestinian side within the coalition refusing to support it. And the right-wing opposition, Netanyahu and his allies, are saying, we're not going to support you. Even though we support this bill, we're not going to save Bennett by coming to his rescue on the right and supporting this bill. He wanted to go into this government with leftists and Palestinians. Let him solve his own problems. So this is within these 2 weeks, just one example of how bound Bennett is to this very weird coalition. And we don't know how this crisis will be solved as of yet. And I think we'll see many more like it.
Right. So you do think that this is a sustainable kind of tension? Because my next question would be, how long does this last until the right wing gets fed up with, you know, or kind of acquiesces and says, we're going to put our fascist politics first?
So that really remains to be seen. I mean, a lot of people are gambling that this government can't survive a few months. That's been Netanyahu's really outspoken message to his supporters. He's been saying this government was formed as part of the fraud of the century, the biggest election fraud in Israeli and maybe world history, and we will topple it within a few months. That's kind of the Netanyahu and Likud and right-wing campaign that's been going on since the government was sworn in.
Sounds familiar.
And maybe he's right. Maybe this coalition is not sustainable because it's made out of such weird alliances. At the same time, almost all, if not all, of the parties to this coalition do have a vested interest in making this work. They want to see Netanyahu really removed from power, not just for a couple of months, but in the long term. They want to stay in power and try to promote policies. And it's a question to what extent they'll be able to negotiate with each other on an ongoing basis on every single point of policy that they'll be facing, where they'll give up, where the left will give in to the right and where the right would actually be willing to consider progressive policies just to sustain this government.
It's a fascinating dynamic. And one of the fascinating elements, too, is the we talked about this in our previous interview, but the role of the Mansour Abbas, formerly of the Joint List. Can you explain what the Joint List is to the audience and kind of this very consequential leaving of Abbas from this, you know, Palestinian-Israeli coalition?
Sure. So in brief, Palestinian citizens make up about 20% of Israeli citizens. These are people who live inside of Israel and not in the occupied territories. And they have always had political representation in Knesset.
And I'm sorry, can we just clarify for people that people in the occupied territories don't have political representation?
Exactly. Thank you. Very much so. They live under a military regime. They can't vote. Israel controls them without them having any say in that. But Palestinian citizens within Israel who can vote have political representation. Their parties, the parties that represent them, have never been a part of any government. Basically, from both sides, you've seen the Jewish Zionist parties saying we don't want to ally with Palestinians, and Palestinians saying as long as this country is an occupying power, as it oppresses our brothers and sisters in the occupied territories, we don't want to be a part of the political game in that way. And in 2015, all these different parties allied to form the Joint List, which was in itself an unlikely coalition. of Islamists with communists, of liberals with nationalists, different factions in Israeli-Palestinian politics allying together to try and promote the rights of the Palestinian minority within Israel. What happened was that list has tried to ally with the center-left to oust Netanyahu as early as 2019. And the center-left has basically refused it and denied its suggestions and chose to ally with Netanyahu instead. And in these latest elections that we had this March, it was actually Netanyahu who started courting the Islamist faction in the joint list, saying, if you break away, I will let you into my government and I'll give you things that you never were able to gain as part of the joint list. And they did. The Islamist faction broke away from the joint list, negotiated with Netanyahu on entering a coalition with him. And at the only reason that didn't happen was that Netanyahu's other allies, those same extreme fascist fundamentalists on the Jewish side that we mentioned before, said no way we're going into a government with the Islamists. So Netanyahu actually was trapped in what he was making himself, the brew that he was making himself in supporting these extremists. And therefore, he wasn't able to form a coalition. But after legitimizing this Islamist faction, the center-left and Bennett and Lapid were able to say, well, if Netanyahu is willing to sit with them, then obviously we can sit with them. And that's how they got Mansour Abbas and the Islamist Party to join them. That's how they're now part of the coalition. And this is a huge shift in the politics of Palestinian citizens that now need to contend for the first time with one of their own parties joining the government, seeing what that means. Some see it as a betrayal and some see it as an opening for a new beginning.
Right. I mean, and I think a lot of that depends on the leadership of Palestinian Israelis and, what they're going to prioritize. My sense of things is that someone like Mansour Abbas is a little more interested in, and again, this is just my read on things from the outside, celebrity or like being at the center of things, being one of the good Palestinian Israelis that can hobnob with the right wing and be in power, than actually say, representing Palestinians in the occupied territories, for example. I know you're a journalist and you may not want to kind of extrapolate on that, but is that a fair read on things?
I think Mansour Abbas, on a personal level, definitely enjoys this status. He's been dubbing himself the kingmaker of Israeli politics ever since these last elections. He's definitely been enjoying the spotlight. We've seen things that we've never seen in Israeli media before. We've seen the evening news open with a press conference in Nazareth by Mansour Abbas with green flags of the Islamic Party behind him. We've never seen so much attention given to Palestinian politics in the Israeli media before. And Mansour Abbas is really central to that. And he's definitely been enjoying that, no question about it. He's also definitely given up on any attempts to affect Israeli policy towards Palestinians in the occupied territories. He doesn't care about that. He doesn't say anything about that. And he will not risk this coalition for Palestinians in the occupied territories. However, one thing to say to his advantage, to a certain degree, I don't think it's only about himself. He did go into this coalition with very high demands for the people that he represents, mostly Bedouins who live in the south of Israel, in the Negev, people who live in unrecognized villages who face house demolitions on a very regular basis, who don't have basic infrastructure of water and electricity. So basically going into this government in exchange for recognition of some of these villages and funds that will be directed to the communities that voted for him, you can say that that's giving up on the national agenda and the kind of broad Palestinian struggle. I think that'll be a very just argument. But at the same time, it's not that he went in only for his own benefit. He did gain, or we'll see if he actually makes good of those promises, but he did get some promises to affect and support his base of constituents.
So I want to turn back to the new, government and the members of the cabinet ministers, and you know, what their beliefs are, how they could execute those beliefs. A lot of them are from Netanyahu's, like, orbit, but are just repurposed and repackaged, and they're right wing. So, you know, I'm forgetting which minister it is, but whose pet issue is no more African migrants to Israel. Those are some of the topics that I think, you know, dominate the powers there. If you could just give us a sense of who this cabinet is going to be occupied by.
So you're very right. And as you mentioned, we actually have two people now in power who've in part built a career on campaigning against the very, very few. We're talking about tens of thousands of African asylum seekers that are currently in Israel. And those two politicians, Ayelet Shaked and Gideon Saar, are now respectively the Minister for Internal Affairs and the Minister of Justice. And in between the two of them, their mandate to actively pursue a policy of deportation of asylum seekers is almost unlimited. And it's something that they both said they're about to pursue. It's not just an old political message that they had. It's actually part of what they're planning to do right now. Again, we'll have to see, will the left stand for it? Is that where the left draws the line in this coalition? Or will they say, it's their ministry, it's their call? That is yet to be seen. But the same goes to, and both these people are former Netanyahu allies. Gideon Saar, until recently, was part of Netanyahu's party, Likud. Ayelet Shaked was Netanyahu's chief of staff for a while, was running operations for him in different capacities, and was a minister under him after that. So the same goes for the Minister of Finance, Avigdor Lieberman, who has built his career on inciting against ultra-Orthodox communities and Palestinian communities. So these are the poorest communities in the country. And as Minister of Finance, his economic plan will have very dire impact on these poor communities. So we're definitely not looking at a promising government. These are all allies of Netanyahu. The way in which the right has taken hold on Israeli politics is very, very concerning, is very, very deep. And at the same time, like I said, it really is too early to know, just because we have other parts of this government and we don't yet know how far the right can actually promote its policies without meeting internal opposition.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned the left, which kind of brings me to my next question, which is, you know, how is the left kind of able to mount... I mean, you mentioned that just the convenience of this coalition of getting Netanyahu out does provide an opening, which is really great, and a silver lining for the left in Israel that I feel like hasn't been seen for a long time. But, you know, you write in your piece in Plus 972 magazine, which I'd encourage everyone to check out, that 101 of the 120 Knesset seats are Jewish supremacist seats, and that's a significant percentage. I'm terrible at math, but that's a lot of right-wing Jewish supremacy seats, and I'm not even sure how one overcomes that, which is just, I mean, from a Palestinian perspective, that's incredibly daunting.
I agree. It's definitely troubling. But the interesting thing in this coalition is that those other 20, the more progressive voices that you have in Knesset, are actually, some of them, or most of them, are actually a part of the coalition. So that question of how much they intervene, they did go into this coalition with the main goal of getting rid of Netanyahu. But at the same time, now they're in power. The coalition depends on them. So just as Naftali Bennett, who commands only 6 seats in Knesset out of 120, was able to extract becoming prime minister, which is completely unheard of in Israeli politics, that the head of such a small party gets to be prime minister. And he was able to get that just because the others wanted to get rid of Netanyahu so badly. Just as that happened, we now have the left that is part of this coalition. The coalition depends on the left, and it can draw a line. It can say, as we've seen before, or are seeing right now with the citizenship law, it can stop other policies from happening. It won't be able to stop each and every right-wing policy from happening because it doesn't want to lose power. It doesn't want this coalition to collapse. So it'll be a very, very interesting game of just where they decide to draw the line and where they give up. I'm afraid that one of the central pieces on which they are already giving up is the occupation. You don't see the left demanding removing the siege on Gaza or ending the occupation. They know they don't have enough power to make that happen. So it'll be in smaller policy questions, but the big questions of this reality of Israeli or Jewish supremacy, that is not something that's going to shift, unfortunately.
Which, you know, brings me to kind of where we'll wrap shortly, is from your perspective, how does the left seize back power? I mean, what does it take? To me, based on my read of things and based on what I've read of your work, it's got to be some sort of international loss. The United States backing out of protecting Israel because of the violation of United Nations terms and human rights violations, etc. Perhaps, you know, adjusting its posture, which we are not seeing under Biden whatsoever. And its European allies doing the same. Would you imagine that that's kind of the moment that would spur some sort of change and a resurgent left, that would be the necessary kind of moment for that to happen?
So I think there are different external factors that might affect where the left is going. Definitely international pressure to end apartheid, which I think is an important thing in of itself, will change Israeli politics. The same can be said of a massive Palestinian uprising that will once again kind of force Israelis to contend with the reality of occupation, just how violent it is towards Palestinians when they need to contend with Palestinian resistance. So those two things are kind of external factors to Israeli politics. At the same time, I don't want to make it easier on the Israeli left by saying, just let's sit and wait until one of these external factors happens, and then, you know, then we'll get this opportunity to make a difference. I think the left has a responsibility to actually make a stand, to go back to having a very explicit ideology and fighting for that ideology. What we've seen in recent years, essentially the left give up on most of its ideology to this point of anything but Netanyahu, accepting Bennett as a replacement for Netanyahu. And that is part of this schism of the Israeli society that was formed around this one person. But with Netanyahu removed, Israeli politics can reorganize itself, hopefully. And a part of that has to be for the left to offer a comprehensive agenda, both of the occupation, but also a progressive social agenda and a progressive agenda on climate and on gender and on other issues within the Israeli society itself, and try and win support as the left should do everywhere. So we've not seen something like that coming from the left in a very, very long time. The focus on just fighting back Netanyahu has been, I think, decapitating in many ways for the left. And now there's this opportunity to actually stand up and say, we want to fight for our own policies. And I think that's a huge burden on the people in coalition to make that struggle from within, or to say at some point, we can't go on with this coalition. We're selling out our values and prolonging not the rule of Netanyahu, but the rule of the right. And at some point they would have to leave this coalition and say, we want an alternative.
Well, thank you so much, Hagai Matar, award-winning Israeli journalist and executive director of Plus 972 Magazine's Advancement of Citizen Journalism. People can find your work there. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Biden and gun control. We'll be right back. So yesterday, Biden had an address and he talked about a new gun control approach. I mean, this is not legislation in the House or the Senate because, by the way, you know, the Biden administration has decided it's not a huge priority for us to kind of strong arm Manchin or Sinema into adjusting the filibuster in any way, which means that any gun control measure in terms of legislation is pretty much dead on arrival. But, you know, Biden has some ideas about gun control, which I'm going to dissect shortly, I think are dangerous in many ways. Some of them are common sense, but the framing with which he approaches things is peculiar to me. Let's take a listen.
The Second Amendment, from the day it was passed, limited the type of people who could own a gun and what type of weapon you could own. You couldn't buy a cannon. Those who say the blood of the blood of patriots, you know, and all the stuff about how we're going to have to move against the government. Well, the Tree of Liberty is not water with the blood of patriots. What's happened is that there have never been, if you wanted to think you need to have weapons to take on the government, you need F-15s and maybe some nuclear weapons. The point is that there's always been the ability to limit, rationally limit, the type of weapon that can be owned and who can own it.
Yeah, so Matt, I know you wanted to jump in there.
Well, the first limitation that comes to mind, like historically, is like, don't sell to the Native Americans. And like, even if it's just like the guns that you can, you're willing to part with, right? Because the problem is like, I mean, look, I'm a little bit skeptical of this as an emphasis. I think like, if you're going to do anything about guns in this country, it needs to be a massive structural thing where you're not just going after illegal, like, sales and stuff like that. Cause guess who that's going to end up criminalizing? You're going to have to do something structurally about the arms industry, which the, US government sort of exists to facilitate business for. So like, I'm skeptical of this as an emphasis right now, in the light of like what's not being done, right? Like we're not, is the PRO Act, that's just not, we're not something we're going to do now. We're not going to do anything on healthcare. This Pelosi's talking nice about the infrastructure, saying we're not going to do the bipartisan thing unless the reconciliation bill gets done. I'd love to see that happen, but I'm just skeptical because, I mean, and just to double back to the point about guns is like, there's a lot of communities for which, and I'm not saying this is smart. I think statistically you might accidentally, you know, discharge your firearm and kill somebody with it. But there's a long history in this country of a need for, or a desire for a firearm for communal deterrence. Like, right? Like, like we get callers in who are like, I'm black. I like feel like having a firearm in my community is nice because I don't necessarily trust the police in case something happens, right? Like, and that's a problem with, these need structural fixes and not just criminalizing certain types of behavior, in my opinion. And I think it's just risky politically. I think it speaks to like the like Bloomberg type liberal who is a technocrat and is going to blow any kind of type of populism into the right.
Yeah, I mean, all of what you said makes sense. It's essentially, you know, being tough on crime, criminalizing responses to poverty by, you know, using that exact language where it's essentially owning the libertarian type who wants their AK-47 and not addressing root causes of what makes people unsafe. So as I mentioned or hinted at earlier, part of this proposal includes reallocating coronavirus funding to the police. So last summer, we had mass protests about defunding the police. And Biden has said this before, you know, maybe we should give police more funding because then they can be better at their jobs, which is just so indicative of his small thinking on this kind of topic. No. They don't need more funding. You don't need to throw more finances at an institution that's structurally insufficient at the very least, but it's not just insufficient, it's murderous. And it's unable to meet the needs of the community and keep the community safe. If safety is truly the priority, and it's not just arming and giving more money to police departments for toys for them to play with, then what Biden should be doing is reallocating that coronavirus money that would be going towards police combating gun violence. And by the way, illegal gun sales, like, talk about small thinking as well. It should be going towards housing. It should be going towards health care. It should be going towards infrastructure in high crime areas that allow people to go and be safe in. If safety is actually the priority, then you would be investing in housing number one, because a lot of what causes violence in these areas, and where we're seeing an increase in gun violence, and by the way, the rest of crime in 2020 went down, rapes, et cetera, everything that didn't involve, or theft, I believe, I'm not exactly sure, but most of, and in other nations, crime went down in general in 2020 because people were indoors, even nations that had stricter lockdown measures. So, I mean, it's about targeting the root of these things as opposed to, as Matt said, giving a speech that kind of throws red meat at the Bloomberg types who want to hear about how stupid it is that right-wingers love guns. Yes, we need more gun control measures, but it's not going to be dealt with in a piecemeal way. You've got to abolish or amend the filibuster, and then we can have a conversation about gun control, because whatever Biden's doing here, it's insufficient at the minimum, and mostly what it's doing is just giving more money to cops, which is exactly what activists and the left did not want. It's counterproductive, and I mean, like, the exact wrong response to what we saw over the summer with the George Floyd protests, and goes to show that the Democratic Party was not interested in doing anything legislatively about this. They saw the conviction of Derek Chauvin and they said, thank God, there's no pressure on us to put legislation through. What, Matt?
I was just saying, absolutely.
Yeah, and they want to fundraise off of this. They want to fundraise off gun violence, and they want to fundraise off of Black Lives Matter and not really do anything about it. I mean, they're complacent in that area. So Biden's putting together this very tiny package about gun violence that does not address root causes, that might criminalize people who are already hurting, and they're going to say, okay, we're done with it. But, like, glad he got to own right-wingers in that statement. Maybe I'm being too harsh, but to me, this is just, like, indicative of many larger problems by Joe Biden. But that is our show today. Have a wonderful day. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Brendan. We'll see you tomorrow.
All right. Should I bring in Brandon? We'll bring Matt and Brandon in now.
That was a good fake out, Emma.
Well, which one?
Your redirection after the first hour. I feel like it was much more, it's good, better head fake than Sam's.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's just, for some reason, he hasn't mastered it yet. We've been doing this for many, many months at this point. I love shitting on him when he's not here. Hey, Brandon.
Hey, you mean me or Matt?
Both of you.
I prefer to be shit on when I'm here.
Well, I mean,
so John McAfee.
Now I'm too cowardly, so.
Well, you know, honestly, I lost a train of thought on that one. Sorry.
So I'm on Sam's computer here, and I just see Velveteen Rabbit buttons in the Google search.
I mean, I don't even know what that means. I'm not a spring chicken anymore, but that reference went over my head.
Yeah, no one got it. I think I'm more and more convinced that there is some sort of anti-Semitism behind it.
Frankly, I would never go on Steven Crowder's show because I'd be afraid that he'd call me some like slur I wouldn't recognize because it was from the 1940s. Like, right. Like, oh, you know, I got a moon cricket on my show, and you're like, what? Like, I'm sorry, is that a slur, or are you you know, have you heard about my fursona?
You know, with the Peanuts one, at first I was like, okay, well, you know, he monitors this show pretty heavily. Maybe he saw the Letter Hacks Peanuts version of the Majority Report.
Damn, I hadn't thought of that.
but then his co-host brings up the Solus thing. When you combine that with the eye references, then I think you have a much clearer picture
right.
of what's going on here.
Well, what a week. How are you, Matt? And what's happening on Doomed?
I'm doing good. You know, it's been quite the week to just watch unfold. You know, all these articles about Sam Cedar owning Steven Crowder. It's pretty crazy.
Forbes magazine.
And Forbes, right? And Newsweek and Vice, and you know, but all those are liberal rags, you know.
Anyway, conflict of interest, is that why you couldn't write about it at Mashable?
Yeah, I probably would not be able to write about that one. Yeah. or I would need it, full disclosure up front. I actively work for this man and rooted him on during the debate. Anyway, youtube.com/Matt Binder tonight will be a great show at 9 p.m. Eastern time. I am working on the guest, but it's going to be a great show. You know, some weeks, you know, you have a guest up front really early. Other times you grab one at the last minute. But I have a number of interesting things coming up in the works that I should drop now because it'll cement them to happen. One is the one of the guys from Convo Couch, one of those super door-esque leftist quote unquote shows wants to debate me about why we should reach out to the Boogaloo Boys.
Okay.
And this is one of the guys who was decided that seeing Steven Crowder and Sam Cedar go at each other meant that would be a great time to try to own Sam for some reason. I mean, I don't get leftists like that. You don't like Sam, fine, but that's a weird opportunity to go after him, you know? Sort of cements where you stand, right?
Lots of purported Jimmy Dore fans in my mentions saying how Sam was wrong to ambush Crowder. I'm like, well...
Right, really weird. And then also, I mean, I know lesser people than I are banned. But Tim Pool is in touch with me to have me go out to the Tim Pool house in July.
Oh, God.
We'll see what happens with that. I am super open to it. And obviously I reached out to him and he reached out to me. And we are going to hopefully actually make it happen.
Well, that sounds lovely. Brandon, what is happening over on the discourse?
Well, we actually just put out another episode. And I say actually because it's always a surprise to my, you know, me included when a new one comes out on the SoundCloud. So you can head over there. Cops in Kente Cloth is the name of the episode. You know, I love alliteration, unless that's not alliteration. It's something else that I don't know about. I will say I don't know about this Tim Pool character, other Matt. But I always find his branding to be so confusing. Like, is the house not called the Pool House? Is he some like sort of YouTuber who has like one of those YouTube prankster houses? Like, shouldn't it be called the Pool House?
It's called like the Beanie something, isn't it? Because of his,
like, yeah, it's like the compound of some name. I don't even remember what it's called.
I only know him through osmosis, but I just feel like all of his stuff should be pool themed. Like, you know, his podcast should be called The Deep End or like The Shallow End with Tim Pool or like, you know, The Pool House. Like, it writes itself. It's really, you know, these are easy layups.
Oh, well, yeah. Do you remember, I mean, he was coming out with a sports drink and it should have been called Pool Water?
Yes, you were. Yeah,
that'd have been good.
You think so?
I mean, people always tell me I'm dropping the ball by not taking my last name and making everything a Mitt Romney Binders Full of Women reference. But I mean,
that's not as much.
It is what it is.
As the pool thing.
I think of Binder and Binder, and I think of that class action law firm.
Right. I think they're social security lawyers.
Oh, okay.
They're actually very, very, very distant cousins to my dad. I've never met them.
There you go.
I've never met them.
Well, with that said, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Oh, yeah. Napoleon the Legend on tonight at 8 Eastern. We're going to be talking about Biden's infrastructure stuff. We'll see what the state of play at that is this evening. Also be talking about the miners bringing the fight to NYC, the socialist mayor in Buffalo, the U.S. is now going to investigate their own boarding schools. There's another revelation of a mass grave in Canada this morning. I think 700 bodies or something like that this time. So the U.S. is going to investigate there. So all that tonight, 8 Eastern, Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get the post game.
All right, 646-257-3920. Binder is going to be responsible for the calls today because I'm having some difficulty on my end. So you have all the power in the world, Bender. Just
I'm assuming the systems are still recovering from Sam Cedar being teleported into the Steven Crowder show's stream.
Yes, the computers were working overtime. Again, 646-57-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Bring back DJ Denner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.
Back.